In terms of the effect it would have, I think it's not. In fact, I think it's worse in some ways than Citizens United.
This week on Tell Somebody, we'll talk to public citizen attorney Scott Nelson about an upcoming Supreme Court case that some are calling Citizens United 2.0.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. Stay tuned now for Tell Somebody with Tom Clammer.
Hello, and welcome to Tell Somebody, www.tellsomebody.us, on Twitter, at Tell Somebody Now, on Facebook, facebook.com/tellsomebodynow. If you have any comments or questions on the show, drop me a line at mail@tellsomebody.us, mail@tellsomebody.us. The views and opinions expressed on this show are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily reflect those of the station or anybody else involved with it. The podcast of last week's show with CIA analyst Ray McGovern talking about Syria is now online. Go to www.tellsomebody.us and click on a tile for a link to that or any other past show. A quick note, PeaceWorks Kansas City's 22nd annual UnPlaza Art Fair is this weekend, Saturday, September 21st, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m., and Sunday, September 22nd, 12 noon to 5 p.m., and that's at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church grounds, 4501 Walnut in Kansas City, Missouri. More information at www.peaceworkskc.org. On with the show. As we've heard recently from Bob McChesney talking about dollarocracy and the money and media election complex on this show, and from others elsewhere, in the wake of a corrupt Citizens United Supreme Court decision, about $10 billion were spent in the 2012 election cycle. You think Citizens United was bad enough? Our guest tonight says that another case coming up this October could, in some ways, be even worse. Sean McCutcheon, a rich conservative from Alabama, gave a lot of money to political campaigns and committees in the 2012 election cycle, and he wanted to give even more, but he had maxed out what he was allowed by the law to give. With the support of the Republican National Committee, McCutcheon is challenging those limits, and the Supreme Court has agreed to hear the case this fall. To find out more about this case, McCutcheon versus Federal Election Commission, and why it is so important, I contacted public citizen attorney Scott Nelson. Scott L. Nelson is an attorney at the Public Citizen Litigation Group in Washington, D.C., where he has practiced since August of 2001. Both in private practice and at Public Citizen, Mr. Nelson's law practice has centered on civil litigation and on civil and criminal appellate practice, including practice before the United States Supreme Court. His clients have included a former President of the United States, a sitting United States District Judge, the American Bar Association, and the American Historical Association. I recorded this conversation with Scott Nelson on Tuesday. Give a listen. Scott Nelson, welcome to Tell Somebody.
Thank you.
Recently on Bill Moyer's website, I read a piece by Joshua Holland talking about a case, McCutcheon versus Federal Election Commission, that he called Citizens United 2.0. And I imagine a lot of people are like me in that they haven't heard about this one. What is this case?
The McCutcheon case is a challenge brought by the Republican National Committee and one of its big donors. And what they're challenging are limits that federal law imposes on the total amount that any individual can give candidates and political parties and other political committees in any two-year election cycle. Right now, the federal law limits a person to giving about $124,000 in a two-year period, which is obviously a lot of money. It's twice what most people in this country make in a year. But according to the people challenging the law, that limit violates the First Amendment rights of people who would like to give even more money than that to politicians and political parties.
And someplace, it may have been SCOTUS blog, I saw this portrayed as something of a rehash of Buckley versus Vallejo in
the
70s.
Yeah, the case is called Buckley versus Vallejo.
Vallejo.
And it was from 1976, a long time ago now. But it kind of has set the framework in some ways for how the Supreme Court has dealt with the First Amendment and campaign finance limits ever since. And what the court said in that case, after Watergate, Congress had amended what's called the Federal Election Campaign Act, which is the basic federal law that imposes limits on what people can give to people who are running for federal office. And it had done two things. It had first imposed limits on the amounts of contributions that anybody could give to a candidate. And it also had tried to limit the amounts that people could spend to broadcast or otherwise put out messages about elections. And what the court said there is, well, spending limits and contribution limits, as far as we're concerned, are very different things. They said a spending limit, saying you can only spend, you know, $5,000 on campaign ads, that's like a direct limit on your ability to speak. And so they have subjected those kinds of limits to very strict First Amendment scrutiny, and they've struck most of them down. But on contribution limits, they said, well, contributing money to somebody isn't speech exactly. It may facilitate speech. It's kind of speech related. You know, Stephen Colbert might call it speechy, but it's not real speech, and so it doesn't get the full protection of the First Amendment. And Congress can put limits on the amounts that people can contribute to candidates and political parties in order to prevent the possibility of corruption that would exist if people are just writing, you know, multi-million dollar checks to political office holders. And so in Buckley, the court actually upheld an earlier version of the limits that are at issue in this case. At that time, the total limit on the amount you could contribute was $20,000. Now it's about six times that. So what the challengers are really asking in this case is for the court to go back and reconsider what it said in Buckley and has said many times since, which is that contribution limits are generally okay.
Okay. Now, in comparing this to Citizens United, I guess they're, these cases are in the same big arena, but some differences. This doesn't involve corporate personhood at all, as I understand
it. That's right. This is all about individuals, because corporations are still prohibited from directly contributing money to candidates and political parties. And the Supreme Court actually passed up a chance to take on that issue this year. There was a case in a federal court of appeals that said, you know, even in light of Citizens United, it's still permissible to prevent corporations from donating money to candidates directly. And the Supreme Court let that decision stand. But that's all based on again, this distinction between contribution limits and spending limits. So Citizens United involved a spending limit. It said corporations can't spend money on elections at all. And the court said that's like preventing the corporation from speaking about politics. This case is not about a direct limit on, or what the court considers a direct limit on speech, but about giving money, and it's about individuals giving money. So the two big differences is Citizens United involved corporations, this involved individuals, but maybe more relevant from the standpoint of how the Supreme Court looks at the issue, Citizens United involved limits on campaign spending, and this case involves limits on campaign contributions.
And I understand you're representing two congressmen who have filed friend of the court briefs?
That's right. Together with some other attorneys, including Fred Wertheimer, who's a longtime leader in the area of campaign finance reform, and his organization, Democracy 21, Public Citizen, and also a lawyer named Seth Waxman, who's the former Solicitor General of the United States and has appeared in front of the Supreme Court. I can't say more than anybody else now living, but he's up there among probably the top 10. We joined forces to write a brief on behalf of Representatives Chris Van Hollen and David Price, defending the law that's at issue here.
And who will be arguing this for the government, for the Federal Election Commission?
For the Federal Election Commission, it's going to be argued by the current Solicitor General of the United States, Donald Verrilli. He's the top official in the Department of Justice when it comes to arguing cases in the courts. So he's also an extremely experienced advocate. He, among other recent arguments, argued on behalf of the United States in the cases about gay marriage, and he argued the defense of the administration's health care plan. So they put up their ablest highest ranking Supreme Court advocate to defend this law.
And in the oral arguments, will it be just he speaking for one side and a McCutcheon attorney for the other, or how does that work?
Yeah, it's going to be just the Solicitor General defending the law. Now, it's kind of interesting. On the other side, there are two different parties who are actually challenging this law. One is the Republican National Committee, and one is this fellow named Sean McCutcheon, who's a businessman who wanted to you know, give more money than these overall limits would allow. And they have different lawyers, and the court in those circumstances usually says, you know, absent exceptional circumstances, it doesn't divide up the argument, so they have to pick one or the other. And the lawyer that they've chosen to argue the case is the lawyer for the Republican National Committee, whose name is James Bopp, and he's brought a lot of these cases. But interestingly, the Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell, filed a motion. He filed a friend of the court brief supporting the Republican National Committee and McCutcheon challenging the law. He filed a motion asking to have his lawyer split time with James Bopp, even though he's only a friend of the court, and that usually isn't allowed. But the court actually granted that motion, so there are going to be two lawyers dividing up half an hour challenging the law, and one lawyer has half an hour to defend it.
And
generally, you don't really want to divide up your time at the Supreme Court because a half an hour is not a lot of time. But I think Senator McConnell felt that he wanted to get his lawyer in there alongside of the person actually arguing the case. We'll see how that works out for them.
Yeah. And
sometimes with only, you know, what it's going to be is McConnell's lawyer is going to have 10 out of those 20 minutes or 10 out of those 30 minutes. And, you know, sometimes in the Supreme Court, you know, you barely get good morning out of your mouth before you're hit with a question. And, you know, in 10 minutes, sometimes it's kind of hard to get your points out.
Yeah. And I understand this will be this coming October 8th, is that right?
Yeah, October 8th, Tuesday. It's the second day of arguments at the court this fall.
And I don't know if this is a big deal question or not, but in the Public Citizen press release about this at citizen.org/pressroom, it spoke of the RNC, Republican National Committee, and it spoke of McCutcheon wanting to donate to three Republican National Committees.
Yeah, well, you see, this is why the aggregate limits that are involved here are so important. That $124,000 limit, I think it's actually $123,800, is divided into two separate limits, one of about $48,000 and one, I think, about $74,000. The $48,000 is the overall limit on the amount you can give to candidates, and the $74,000 is the amount you can give to political parties and political committees in a two-year period. And, you know, separately, there are limits on what you can give to any one candidate or any one party or committee. You can give $2,600 per candidate per election, which usually means $5,200 over the course of a two-year period, because you can give separately for primary and general elections. And for political party committees, you can give $32,000 a year. Now, here's what's interesting about political party committees. Each of the two national parties has three of what they call national party political committees. For the Republicans and the Democrats, they both have what they call the Republican and Democratic national committees. But then they each have a senatorial campaign committee and a congressional campaign committee. So if you took away this aggregate limit, you could give $32,000 each year to each of those three party committees for each party. So if you wanted to give only to Republicans, you could give $96,000 in one year, and then, you know, $190,000 in the course of a total 2-year election cycle. But because of the aggregate limit, the overall limit on the amount you can give to political parties, it's only about $74,000 that you can give. So without these limits, each party can basically collect another $120,000 per election cycle from each of its big donors, which is quite a hefty amount of money, and that's why the Republican National Committee is so interested in this case.
And I can't find the exact numbers right now, but in an email or someplace I read of some more staggering figures, like what is the total now individual?
The thing is, each of the political parties also has a 50 state party committees, and there's a you know, again, the individual limit on the amount you can give to any one of those for state parties is $10,000 a year, and that's all within that 74,000 something aggregate limit. Well, if you take away the aggregate limit, you can give $10,000 a year to each of 50 state party committees. That totals out to be $1 million in the course of an election cycle. And the beauty of that for the parties is all these party committees, the state and national parties, they can transfer money among themselves as they choose. And they kind of have an overall coordinated strategy. So, you know, as far as they're concerned, giving money to one of them is pretty much as good as giving to any other. So from the standpoint of what this would do, if you look at it from the standpoint of the Republican Party, say that people who now are limited to giving them only about $75,000 in a two-year period, now they could give them almost $1.2 million. That's just to the parties. Then add in the candidates. Well, each party has 455 congressional candidates and 33 senatorial candidates, and in a presidential election year, it's got a presidential candidate. And again, there you can currently give $5,200 per election cycle to one candidate, but that's all subject to that $48,000 aggregate limit. Take that away, you could give $5,200 to, 486 candidates, and, you know, do the math, and that works out to somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 million something. So, what could happen if the aggregate limits went away is the party leaders and their elected officials just sort of set up a combined program where they ask for the maximum amount to go to all their parties and all candidates, and they're calling people up and asking them to write them checks for about $3 million.
Wow. So I'm guessing you might say calling this Citizens United 2.0 is not hyperbole.
Well, in terms of the effect it would have, I think it's not. In fact, I think it's worse in some ways than Citizens United, because you know, what's going on here is you know, sort of direct the direct ability of a politician to ask somebody to write a check for the benefit of himself and his party. And, you know, in Citizens United, at least the spending that it authorizes has to be at least ostensibly independent of the candidates. So, you know, the candidates and the parties really, they value money given directly to them more than they value people sort of going off and doing it themselves. And so, you know, it would, I think, really create opportunities for corrupt bargains that are above and beyond what Citizens United allows. Now, I'm not saying Citizens United doesn't allow for corrupt bargains, because the independence of some of these so-called independent spending groups is pretty questionable, and, you know, we saw cases in the last election of these so-called super PACs, which after Citizens United were created to actually get unlimited amounts of money because they were supposedly engaged in independent spending, and we saw that, you know, super PACs got very chummy with the candidates that they were supporting and with the people who were then writing them multi-million dollar checks. So, you know, the system we now have with Citizens United is bad enough, but you know, so far the court has kind of it has accepted the bulwark against, you know, the most direct forms of corruption of limits on the amount that people can actually give directly to candidates and parties, and you know, this would a ruling for the RNC and McCutcheon in this case would really shatter that bulwark.
In spite of the Citizens United decision and a kind of general sense of the court majority these days, with Roberts being just extremely pro-corporate in all that he's been involved with, and again, I mean, this doesn't directly involve corporations like Citizens United, but there, again, the Public Citizen press release says that precedent is fairly strongly in favor of going against McCutcheon.
Yeah, and, you know, that's a difference from Citizens United. Now, in Citizens United itself, they did have to actually overrule a precedent to get to their result, but there were conflicting lines of precedent that, you know, the court could basically say the decision that we're overruling was just sort of out of step with a lot of other stuff that we've done in this area. But in this case, all the precedent really points in the same direction. And you know, even in Citizens United, the majority opinion and Justice Roberts' concurrence emphasized that cases about contribution limits are different. And even Justice Kennedy, who wrote Citizens United and who wrote a very lengthy dissent back in 2003 when the court upheld the McCain-Feingold law, but even Justice Kennedy in that decision said, you know, the one thing I do agree with is that when you let politicians solicit very large sums of money, even if the money isn't going directly to them, if there's an ask and response kind of relationship in the request for funds and the resulting contribution, that creates a threat of corruption, and I'll uphold limits on people's ability to do that. Well, you know, in this case, taking away these aggregate limits would allow the kind of solicitation of large contributions that even Justice Kennedy recognizes is problematic. Chief Justice Roberts himself, in an opinion a few years back, sort of reaffirmed the distinction that Buckley v. Valeo had drawn between contribution and spending limits, and emphasized that contribution limits are much more likely to be sustained. So, you know, I think that there's a lot of reason to hope that this won't turn out to be a decision that will be damaging in the way that Citizens United was. We're hoping that we're going to win this case, and pretty strongly of the view that we have the better arguments. Now, you know, you don't predict Supreme Court decisions if you've been around long enough to know that sometimes they do things that is unexpected to you. So, you know, I don't like to handicap decisions, but we don't feel like this is a lost cause by any means, and we don't feel like the fact that the court issued a bad decision in Citizens United necessarily means that it's going to in this case.
And tell me if I've got this paraphrase wrong, but Kennedy in his decision is, or opinion in Citizens United talked about disclosure mitigating corruption or appearance of corruption, and I think that's turned out to be something of a joke, but does disclosure enter into this decision at all, or was it going to be handled someplace
else? Yeah, this isn't really a disclosure, a case about disclosure. I mean, this involves the kinds of contributions that one way or another they'll be disclosed. And the main point, I think, is from our point of view, is, you know, we're all for disclosure, and we think that it's helpful, but it's not enough if you know, to disclose contributions, if you're getting up into the sort of stratosphere of contributions in the hundreds of thousands of or millions of dollars, you know, you can disclose them all you want, but that's not going to stop them from having a corrupting effect on the people who receive them.
Uh-huh. And this will be heard October 8th. When might we expect to hear the decision?
Well, the court is pretty regular in its habits in one respect. It starts its year at the beginning of October, and it ends it by around the end of June. And except in a few cases, like Citizens United, where they can't come to a decision for one reason or another and order a re-argument in the next term. Except for those kinds of cases, they'll get all their opinions out by the end of June. You know, ordinarily when a case is decided in October, they start issuing a few opinions in December from some of the earlier cases, but usually the easier of the early cases. And then, you know, if you had sort of an average case decided in October, you'd be kind of surprised if it wasn't decided by February or March. But you know, a case that's higher profile and involves a more controversial subject matter, you know, sometimes those get argued in October and don't get decided till June. So all we can really say, with a fair degree of certainty, is we'll probably get the answer by June.
Okay. Well, Scott Nelson with Public Citizen, any other thoughts you want to leave with our listeners before I let you go?
No, I don't think so. Other than just that, you know, I think it's important to keep paying attention to what the Supreme Court does in this area as well as in a lot of others, and I think that you know, a lot of people, they hear about Supreme Court decisions when they're decided sometimes, and it's kind of a surprise, and you know, people don't really know that these things are coming or what the likely range of outcomes is. So I just appreciate your taking the time to talk about it and think about it and get people thinking about it, because it's very critical to our understanding of our government that we are aware of what the court is doing.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your time, and thank all of you at Public Citizen for the work you do.
Well, I thank you.
Scott Nelson, attorney at the Public Citizen Litigation Group in Washington, D.C., www.citizen.org. Nelson and other attorneys participated in a telephone conference for journalists about McCutcheon versus FEC on Monday. This was put on by a nonprofit group called Rethink Media. There was another telephone conference yesterday. Let's listen into part of that one right now.
Hi, Rich Wolf, USA Today.
Just give us one more minute. Someone's dialing in right now, and then we'll get started. Hi, who just joined?
Hello, yes, this is John Diaz, San Francisco Chronicle.
Hey, John, thanks very much for joining.
Well, thank you for having us.
So, we will go ahead and get started now. Thank you all for your patience. My name is Scott Swenson. I work with Rethink Media, a nonprofit communications organization supporting the work of advocacy groups fighting back against the corrupting influence of money in our political system. On October 8th, when the Supreme Court hears McCutcheon versus FEC, the question before the court pertains to aggregate contribution limits. But in the wake of Citizens United, the American public is paying more attention to the broader question of money in politics and is pushing back by pursuing a number of solutions to the money problem. These include citizen-led redistricting to fight gerrymandering, a push for disclosure of dark money from all sources, small donor campaign finance reform, regulatory and enforcement efforts at the FEC, SEC, IRS, and at the state level. And 16 states and many localities have passed resolutions urging consideration of a constitutional amendment to make clear that people, through their elected representatives, can enforce common sense limits on campaign finance to curb corruption. There is a growing movement to protect our democracy from money, and the McCutcheon case presents the perfect opportunity to look at what is going on with the broader issue. Today we are here to discuss the specifics of the case. Six organizations supporting campaign finance reform filed briefs in this case. Today's call features three of those: the Campaign Legal Center, the Brennan Center, and the Constitutional Accountability Center. On Monday, we hosted a call with the other three, Democracy 21, Public Citizen, and Demos. We split the group to offer reporters the opportunity to select a convenient time, but I encourage you to follow up with the organizations on both calls for additional background information. Now I'd like to introduce Tara Molloy of the Campaign Legal Center to kick us off with a description of what is at stake in McCutcheon v. FEC. Tara Molloy joined the Campaign Legal Center in November of 2006. She litigates a wide range of campaign finance and election law cases in state and federal court and has expertise in campaign finance, lobbying, congressional ethics issues. Ms. Molloy has also served as an associate counsel at the New York City Campaign Finance Board prior to joining the Legal Center. There, she advised the board regarding the administration of New York City's public finance system, represented the board counsel in state and federal courts on various campaign finance matters, and drafted legislation and implementing those rules. Tara?
Hi, Scott. Thank you for hosting this call. I'm going to try and give a quick overview of the McCutcheon case, as well as the Campaign Legal Center response to this challenge. Now, as we all know, the case was brought by Sean McCutcheon, a Alabama businessman, and the RNC, a challenge to the aggregate limits on how much a single individual can give to all candidates, parties, and PACs in a two-year election cycle, set at a eye-popping $123,200 in the 2014 elections. It is pretty unsurprising that very, very few Americans even reach this controversial, apparently, figure, and most were talking about a couple thousand. So this case is really an attempt to vindicate the speech rights of the top 1% of the top 1%, the top 1% of Americans. And final threshold note, the aggregate limits, or at least the predecessor of these aggregate limits, have already been upheld in 1976 in Buckley v. Valeo, the sort of grandfather of all campaign finance law cases. The Supreme Court upheld the original aggregate limit, finding that it was a potent anti-circumvention measure, meaning that without the aggregate limits, people could simply donate many limited contributions to candidates, party committees, PACs, and then they could route all these individually limited contributions to their preferred candidates in a variety of means. This would allow them to basically game the system. To summarize the plaintiff's case in a nutshell, they first argue that the aggregate limit should be subject to a particularly stringent form of judicial review, strict scrutiny. They then argue that even under any standard of scrutiny, they believe that the aggregate limits do not further the governmental interest in preventing political corruption or the appearance of such corruption, and that is really the only governmental interest that the Supreme Court has found valid in terms of justifying campaign finance restrictions. So to first look at the strict scrutiny question, this sounds very technical, but this is really the area where the Supreme Court has the potential to do the most mischief in McCutcheon. The plaintiffs argue that an aggregate limit is particularly burdensome because it doesn't just limit how much you or I can give to a candidate, like a base limit would, but instead it limits how many candidates altogether a individual could contribute to. They then argue, however, that if the Supreme Court doesn't buy this first attempt to heighten scrutiny, they should completely reconsider the Buckley v. Valeo decision, or rather the principle espoused in Buckley v. Valeo that contribution limits are a lesser burden on speech than expenditure limits. Why is this important? Well, because contribution limits are a lesser burden, they are subject to more relaxed review and really invariably and consistently have been upheld by the Supreme Court in the past. If the Supreme Court were to take up the plaintiff's request to thus radically revise Buckley, this would jeopardize not only the aggregate limits but all contribution limits, because all contribution limits would be suddenly subject to a much higher standard of review or a much harder judicial look. So this is a real kernel of concern in McCutcheon, that it is at least potentially a case that could sweep more broadly than even just knocking down the very crucial aggregate limits. In terms of the second half of the plaintiff's argument, they say that the aggregate limits do not really further a governmental goal in reducing corruption, because they maintain that they are still going to comply with the base limits, and so they really will be planning simply to make many, many limited contributions to a wide array of candidates and party committees. They say that, well, if a small $5,000 contribution to a candidate is not corrupting in itself, and if they make 100 of such contributions, it also cannot be corrupting. They also argue that there have been many changes to the federal campaign finance law since Buckley, and these many changes have obviated the need for the aggregate limits because they've blocked the circumvention that Buckley feared. Now, this was the corruption point, was where the Campaign Legal Center in its amici brief really weighed in at the Supreme Court, because we basically said that plaintiffs were being both naive and myopic in their arguments. First, with respect to their first point, that their assumption that if you make many separate contributions to many separate accounts, that is to many separate candidates, that it will not be corrupting, this is simply naive. So federal law allows contributions to be transferred between party committees without any limit. They allow candidates and parties to transfer contributions to a large extent. And so there is really no reason to think that a contribution given to one candidate or one party committee will remain in those accounts. Instead, we imagine or we expect that we will see money shifted around to benefit the candidates that the big donor really wishes to support in the absence of the aggregate limits. We will see the circumvention, the exact circumvention that the Buckley court feared. And in fact, joint fundraising committees, the fundraising technique we saw so often in the presidential elections, have made this even easier, because essentially this is just a mechanism by which many committees, party committees and candidates, join together. They can raise one huge check up to $70,000 under the aggregate limits, and then they simply all sort of divert this money to supporting a single candidate that headlines the effort. Again, this was used by McCain, this was used by Obama, this was used by Romney. This is a well-established way of circumventing the limits, which would only become far more problematic in the absence of aggregate limits. We also say that in terms of their point that separate contributions are, you know, going to remain separate, that even if this were the case, that they are being myopic to think that a single contributor can give $1 million, $2 million, $3 million, and even discrete contributions and not have a corruptive impact on the party or party candidates that they intend to support. In terms of just the figures, absent the aggregate limits, in a single election cycle, one donor could give $2.4 million to all candidates of one party in a single election. They could give an additional $1.2 million to all the party committees of their preferred party. That would be the three federal committees and the 50 state committees of one party. So we're talking about $3.5 million plus to just the candidates and parties committees of their preferred side. And we point out that it's just simply counter to common sense to think that this amount of money could be given without winning the benefactor enormous influence and perhaps governmental largesse and congressional action. And in fact, we tried this experiment once before. It was the soft money regime before the McCain-Feingold Act of 2002 blocked it. And, you know, the record of the Supreme Court decision that upheld the McCain-Feingold Act was replete with examples of how million-dollar contributions to parties really do buy access, influence, and corruption. So this is our response to the plaintiffs, and we are certainly crossing our fingers and watching this case very carefully, both because the aggregate limits are very important to protecting our elections and because, as I mentioned earlier, that this case has a threatens to impact our elections even more broadly by calling into question all contribution limits.
Thanks very much, Tara. Our next speaker is Lawrence Norton. Lawrence is a deputy director of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law. He has authored several nationally recognized reports and articles related to elections and election law. Mr. Norton chaired Ohio's Secretary of State's Bipartisan Election Summit and Conference, authoring a report to the state of Ohio for the purpose of improving the state's election laws and procedures. The Columbus Dispatch praised Mr. Norton for, quote, following the path in developing the report and its recommendations. Larry? Larry, or if you're on mute, you drop mute. Larry, are you still with us? Larry?
Hi, sorry about that. We got cut off for a second.
Okay. I just gave your introduction, so your timing is perfect.
Oh, great. Good. Well, thanks very much, and thanks, everybody, for joining this call. I'm going to talk briefly about the brief that the Brennan Center submitted. It was prepared with the assistance of our pro bono counsel, Davis Polk, and it examines America's long history of protecting the integrity of our government from control of any narrow interest. From Alexander Hamilton to James Madison, the Founding Fathers repeatedly expressed fears that without protections in place, our government could become beholden to narrow, elite, special interests. Specifically, they railed against the type of government corruption that occurs when government officials are more beholden to narrow factions than the American people. They certainly did not envision the First Amendment as protection for moneyed interests seeking to capture government. On the contrary, they saw fighting private corruption of government as a key function of the Constitution and American democracy. In our system of government, there is nothing more important than maintaining the American people's faith in the integrity of their democratic institutions. And as Tara's already discussed, striking down the aggregate limits could have a devastating effect on public faith in our democracy. I want to give some context to the astounding numbers that Tara's already discussed. Currently, there's an aggregate limit of just over $123,000 for any single person to contribute, which is already an extraordinary amount. If the aggregate limits were struck down by the court, one politician could use a joint fundraising committee to directly solicit, as Tara mentioned, more than $3.5 million from a single donor in an election cycle. That number, $3.5 million, is more than 70 times the median annual family income in America. So in other words, for an ordinary American to raise and spend this amount, they would have to do it over several lifetimes. With politicians soliciting seven-figure checks, the cost of running for office will rise exponentially, and a tiny, tiny group of donors who can afford to make those kinds of multi-million-dollar contributions will wield unprecedented power over our elected officials. Given these facts, it is worth remembering, as we point out in our brief, that the First Amendment is meant to ensure that the greatest possible number of Americans will have their voices heard in public conversation that informs elected officials' decisions. Ensuring that political debate does not become the private domain of a wealthy few is imperative if we want to protect the founders' legacy. So in short, a decision striking down the aggregate limits would be terrible for our democracy, but the good news is that based on legal precedents, all legal precedents from the Supreme Court, McCutcheon should be an easy case, Tara mentioned Buckley v. Vallejo in 1976. Since that time, the court has repeatedly upheld aggregate limits on the grounds that unlimited contributions can lead to corruption or the appearance of corruption. In fact, the Supreme Court has never struck down a federal contribution limit as unconstitutional. Since the Citizens United decision, Americans' faith in the Supreme Court and in government in general has neared an all-time low, and it is our belief that the wrong decision here would unfortunately further erode Americans' trust in their courts and elected officials.
Thanks very much, Larry. Next, we'll hear from Elizabeth Wydra of the Constitutional Accountability Center. Elizabeth is the Constitutional Accountability Center's chief counsel. Elizabeth frequently participates in Supreme Court litigation and has argued several important cases in the Federal Courts of Appeals. She joined CAC from private practice at Quinn, Emanuel, Urquhart, Oliver, and Hedges in San Francisco, where she was an attorney working with former Stanford Law School Dean Kathleen Sullivan in the firm's Supreme Court and appellate practice. Previously, Elizabeth was a supervising attorney and teaching fellow at the Georgetown University Law Center, appellate litigation clinic, a law clerk for Judge James R. Browning of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, and a lawyer at Shaw Pittman, a law firm in Washington, D.C. Elizabeth?
Thank you so much, Scott. Can you all hear me? Just want to make sure I'm not...
Yes.
Okay, great. To put it very simply, the constitutional question in this case can be thought of as sort of a balancing or weighing of the McCutcheon, the person who seeks to contribute money, his interest in speech under the First Amendment versus the government's interest in preventing against corruption in politics through this particular campaign finance law. And opponents of the aggregate limits at issue here, like the opponents of the campaign finance law struck down in Citizens United, seek to narrowly define the government's interest here, so that second part of the equation in the First Amendment analysis, by narrowly defining corruption to be limited more or less to examples of quid pro quo, money for votes type of bribery. So the way that this works to help them strike down these laws under the Constitution is that narrowing corruption weakens the government's interest in passing legislation. We saw it at work at Citizens United, and I think McCutcheon and the RNC are hoping that it works as well for them in this case. But the brief filed by my organization, Constitutional Accountability Center, on behalf of Harvard Professor Lawrence Lessig, who is one of the nation's most respected academic voices when it comes to the First Amendment and campaign finance laws, shows that this attempt to weaken the government's interest in regulating money in politics is flat out wrong. Professor Lessig's research, which had never been presented to the Supreme Court before, shows that this incomplete, extraordinarily narrow definition of corruption is badly out of step with the framers of the Constitution's view. Instead, the framers' understanding of corruption was much broader, supporting federal power to safeguard the integrity of our democratic process. So what Professor Lessig and his research team did to get to this result was to code every single mention of the word corruption in founding-era documents and debates, and his results are striking. The vast majority of the times the framers of our Constitution used the term corruption was not, in fact, this narrow, individual-focused, quid pro quo type of corruption that McCutcheon and the RNC say is the government's only legitimate, constitutionally recognized interest in passing campaign finance laws. Instead, the framers of the Constitution used the word corruption to refer to what Professor Lessig calls improper dependence kind of corruption, in which individuals or institutions are dependent on special interests or big money, basically dependent on anything other than the voters on which officials and public institutions are properly dependent. So when you look at this result and in the constitutional provisions that actually made it into the Constitution, as well as sort of background principles, the framers were pretty much obsessed with combating corruption in politics and government. And the federal aggregate contribution limits, like the ones at issue in McCutcheon, are exactly the sort of law that they would have wanted Congress to enact. And I just want to close by saying that I think it's important to note that the American people intuitively know what the founders themselves believed, that big money in politics is a problem, not just because it could lead to bribery or money for votes type scandals, but also because of the way it corrodes the people's faith in our elections and our government. I think that they reacted the way they did to Citizens United because of this intuitive belief, and Citizens United was a deeply unpopular decision. And I think if the Roberts Court strikes down the aggregate contribution limits here, there will be a similar justified outcry.
Thanks, Elizabeth. Before we take your questions, I'd like to make you aware of two events pertaining to McCutcheon v. FEC that are coming up in D.C., the first on September 26th featuring Lawrence Lessig and Senator Elizabeth Warren speaking at the Capitol Visitor Center. I believe the time of that is at noon. It's an event sponsored by the Constitutional Accountability Center, so please follow up with them for specific details. And then on October 1st, Fred Wertheimer and Trevor Potter of the Campaign Legal Center, Fred of the Democracy 21, will be speaking at a newsmaker event at the National Press Club. And I believe Demos and several other organizations are planning a third event about broadening the movement. The time and date for that will be announced shortly. Now we'll take your questions. Please just identify yourself and your media outlet, and the lines are open. If you have muted yourself, please remember to press star 6 to unmute. Your first question?
Yeah, hi, this is John Diaz from the San Francisco Chronicle.
Hi, go ahead, John.
Yeah, the question I had is given the steady erosion that we've seen in campaign finance laws with Citizens United and what appears to be the sentiment of the Supreme Court, is the only real solution here to do a constitutional amendment to assert the right of Congress to put in some reasonable limits? I mean, I guess the thing is, as I hear this, are we going to be fighting this as long as we have the Roberts Court or people of that persuasion?
Hi, this is Tara Malloy from the Campaign Legal Center. I think there's two answers to that question. One, if you want to change or overturn Citizens United, that is the holding that corporate independent expenditures cannot be limited, then yes, really the only way to do that at this point is to pass a constitutional amendment. However, if we want to win McCutcheon, at this point at least, we do not need a constitutional amendment. And I would just point out that although Citizens United was very troubling and perhaps marked was a bellwether case for the Roberts Court, it dealt with a very different type of campaign finance law than the one at issue in McCutcheon. Citizens United looked at a limit on expenditures. McCutcheon looks at a limit on contributions. Again, this is very technical, but the Supreme Court has long distinguished between these two types of, speech. And contribution limits, as I think another speaker noted, have always almost invariably been upheld by the Supreme Court. So I think we are in a slightly different playing field in McCutcheon. Now, that's not to say we aren't very concerned. The fact that the Supreme Court took this case, although it was a direct appeal, but the fact that the Supreme Court took this case is hardly warms a reformer's heart. But even the Roberts Court, I think it's important to note, has shown at least some respect for contribution limits. Chief Justice Roberts, in a 2006 case, Randall v. Sorrell, there a state contribution limit was struck down as too low, but at the same time, Roberts joined an opinion that noted that Buckley was sort of the leading precedent and that Buckley's distinction between contribution limits and expenditure limits was very important and should not be reconsidered, and there was no justification to reconsider Buckley. So Chief Justice Roberts, at least, is on record paying lip service, at least, to Buckley v. Valeo. So it will be interesting to see how it plays out in this slightly new world of campaign contributions as opposed to campaign expenditures.
Well, let me ask the question a slightly different way. Would it be possible to craft a constitutional amendment which would take both care of both of these issues, contribution and spending limits?
I think that the contribution, the constitutional amendments I have seen have been a very wide range of solutions. Some look at simply corporate activity in elections, some look at simply campaign expenditure, that is the independent spending issue, and some give Congress greater authority to regulate all types of campaign activity, whether contributions or expenditures. So I think the answer to that is simply how broadly you word your constitutional amendment or what you're trying to achieve with that amendment.
And this is Elizabeth Weidra from CAC. You know, I think one of the major issues in Citizens United that some of the proposed constitutional amendments get at, and part of which caused such an outcry afterward, is the sort of elevation of corporate rights that we see in Citizens United, sort of the idea that the Roberts Court is treating corporations as well, and in some cases better than everyday living, breathing Americans. And so, you know, I think some of the proposed amendments get at that. But I just want to say that, you know, there is no flaw in the Constitution that needs to be fixed that led to Citizens United. The flaw is the Roberts Court interpretation of the Constitution. And even so, even in Citizens United, which was such a bad decision, the court did note that it has repeatedly sustained limits on direct contribution in order to ensure against the reality or appearance of corruption. That's language from the decision itself. So I think that even in a post-Citizens United world, there is good reason to think that the court could get it right in this case.
Next question.
Hey, it's Ariane with ABC News.
Hi, Ariane. Your question?
Tara, can you go through again, sort of in layman's terms, how one, if aggregate limits were struck down, how one might be able to circumvent the system?
Absolutely. Although it happens all the time, that is circumvention of the system, it is somewhat complicated. At the moment, we are all subject to both base limits and aggregate limits. That is, we are subject to how much we can give to each candidate or party committee, as well as the aggregate limit as to our overall contributions in a two-year election cycle. However, at the moment, the restrictions on how you may direct your money through pass-through entities to your favorite candidates are fairly weak. This is the idea of earmarking. So provided that you do not sort of officially earmark your money to be passed through, say, a party committee to your favorite candidate, then you can really sort of route your money through many different entities to, let's say, Barack Obama. And this is a concern that sort of animates the whole aggregate limits. So imagine a world without any aggregate limits. There are about, I think, 460 candidates that run in any election cycle. You could give $5,200 in 2014 to each of these candidates. Then, you know, with a wink and a nod, you could say, really, I would like Elizabeth Warren to be elected, and these candidates, they might not love giving their money or transferring it to Elizabeth Warren, but, you know, it probably carries them some favor with their party, and they may act as intermediaries. So you use all these candidates as intermediaries. An even more potent way to circumvent the system in the aggregate limits would be to exploit the parties. The parties are made up of three federal committees, each of which can take $30,000 under the base limits, as well as 50 state committees, each of which can take $20,000 or $10,000 each year under the base limits. So a enterprising big contributor simply gives, let's say, to the three national party committees and, let's say, 25 state party committees, and suddenly you have a fairly eye-popping sum. Then again, with a wink and a nod, or by using the joint fundraising technique, they indicate that they want all this money to support Ted Cruz, whether through coordinated spending by the party, by transfers to his campaign, or through independent spending by the party to support Ted Cruz. So because there are so many different players in the political system, by sort of unofficially indicating your preferences, you can ensure that just a couple candidates really benefit from your largesse. And, of course, the frightening downside of this for democracy is that it's very likely that those eventual beneficiaries are going to be very grateful to their donors, even if they have to use the subterfuge of circumvention to get the money to their favorite candidates. So this was the concern that Buckley really cited when it upheld the original aggregate limits in 1976.
And we expect that these type of schemes would multiply or really just explode if indeed McCutcheon were to come down the wrong way this year.
So as far as the joint fundraising committees, it would be using joint fundraising committees to channel money given to individual candidates broadly?
Well, imagine, I'll give you an example. So in 2012, both Obama and Romney created joint fundraising committees with their parties. Now, what they usually did is that they created a joint fundraising committee of their own campaign, let's say Obama campaign, the DNC, and four state committees. This is a number because at that point there was a $70,000 aggregate limit on how much they could gather. So a big contributor would just give $70,000 to this joint fundraising committee, which was called like Obama Victory. And technically, yes, the money would be split between Obama, the DNC, and the four state party committees. Then, however, a contributor could assume, rightly, that all this money would be ultimately used either in coordinated expenditures or independent expenditures to support the headliner candidate, Obama. So it's a way for the donors to signal who they want to support while technically contributing to many different entities. This, however, was there were some breaks on this effort in 2012 because of the aggregate limits. You could only give up to about $70,000 altogether. In the absence of the aggregate limits, you know, we're talking about a sum of more like $1 million to all the different party committees that could join with, for instance, a presidential candidate or a different candidate in a joint fundraising effort.
Well, that's it. We're out of time. You've been listening to the podcast edition of Tell Somebody, www.tellsomebody.us. Comments or questions, send an email to mail@tellsomebody.us. You can also follow me on Twitter @TellSomebodyNow. The Tell Somebody podcast is produced and distributed by Tell Somebody and may or may not reflect the broadcast of Tell Somebody, heard on 90.1 FM KKFI in Kansas City, streaming around the world at www.kkfi.org. I'll be on 90.1 FM KKFI every Thursday morning at 9, right after Democracy Now! If you haven't heard Tell Somebody before, I hope you'll listen again. Check out the podcast and the broadcast. Click on a tile at www.tellsomebody.us for a link to a past show. If you enjoyed the show and appreciated the information you got from it, please tell somebody about the podcast and the broadcast. Spread the word to your friends and contacts by word of mouth or Facebook or Twitter or email list or any other way you can think of. This is Tom Clammer. I'll see you next Thursday at 9 a.m. on Tell Somebody, or anytime you like, at www.tellsomebody.us.